From an early age, he'd be playing Jerry Bergonzi, great tenor saxophonist with the Dave Brubeck Quartet in the 70s. It's a fantastic album called Back Home, which we used to play on the record player all the time. And I pretty much learnt all of his solos, even as a 12-year-old kid. I wouldn't have been able to play them, but I knew them in my head. So that was a great start. And I also had a really musical public school that I went to, Linfield Demonstration School that was. Now it's Linfield Public School. So I was always very well encouraged. My mum's a piano player and she sings very well, and we also had a lot to do with the local church. Brother's musician, so it was always just around me. So,
who are your main musical influences, and are they necessarily saxophonists?
I pretty much like all styles of music. I suppose I'm most schooled in jazz, but I'm certainly not limited to that. So I suppose I could say, in terms of jazz musicians, I think probably, you know, you've got your classic saxophonists, Parker, Coltrane, Wayne Shorter, Joe Henderson, Sonny Rollins, probably my first biggest influence. And then sort of moving on from there, Brecker. And I suppose in pretty much for the last 10 or 11 years, Chris Potter, almost exclusively on the saxophone. I just can't fathom how good a musician that guy is, so he constantly amazes me. So saxophone wise that kind of thing, but also just conception of music and jazz, I suppose Keith Jarrett, Pat Metheny, Charles Mingus, Monk, Miles Davis, of course. So those kind of band leaders and composers. But then with all that, there's world music influences. I've traveled to Turkey and I've really enjoyed the musicians over there and the albums that I've bought from that country. There's classical music, so I love J.S. Bach, St. Matthew's Passion, probably my favourite thing to put on any time. And I love rock, I love Radiohead, and I like even some metal. There's a great band from Australia in Perth called Carnival, and they're fantastic. So I pretty much listen to anything. I love Katie Noonan with Paul Grabowski and that kind of thing. Yeah, there's not many things I don't like.
But it's taken some time for you to produce this recording, and from what I've read to date, Kristen Berardi, the vocalist on board, was very much the catalyst for it coming to fruition.
Yes.
So tell us about that.
Well, I went and heard Kristen in June last year at the Excelsior with her band, and it was just an extraordinary performance. She just had a presence on stage that was just unbelievable. I loved her compositions and I loved the emotion that she sang with. And I suppose communication is what I'm looking for most in any musician or any band. And that is, are they communicating something to me of them? And she communicated just her total being through her voice.
She's very natural on stage, isn't she?
Yeah.
It's almost as if she really hasn't changed persona from when she's walked on stage.
Yeah, that's
it's
right.
It's like she is talking to her audience.
Very much so. And she's just a consummate musician. Yeah, she absolutely blows me away with her commitment and conviction of what she believes the music requires at any one point. So, yeah, I'm terribly blessed to have had her collaborate with me on this record.
This is the opening track, Whisper. What have you got to tell us about this one?
This tune, like some of the other tunes on the record, actually was written quite a few years ago. I think about 99, maybe even 2000. And it's a tune in 7/4, which is, you know, a slightly odd kind of meter. But I suppose what captivates me about the song is that it's got a chord progression that I find beautiful, and it's a 6-bar kind of repeated melody the greater part of the piece, and it's got a melody that just keeps going over and over again. It's sort of almost minimalistic kind of a approach to jazz. So, and when I knew I was going to have Kristen in the band, and I know Gary Daly's an accordion player, I just thought I'd love to hear those two timbres together, which is what we've got on the record. And it's interesting, John Clare in his review yesterday in the Herald said it reminded him of breezy French movie jazz, which I don't think it was a knock. I think he actually really enjoyed it, but it does remind me of that too.
Richard, as a musician and improviser, how do you measure the success of your craft?
That's a good question, Frank. Tempted to say by how well people respond to my music, but I know that that's a purely kind of subjective emotional response that is not always very true to get a yardstick measurement from. So I think an improviser knows when they're being honest, basically, And I suppose that's what I aim for, is honesty in playing music. So I actually studied Warren Marsh, a fairly unknown saxophonist in terms of how great a musician he was. I did a thesis on him, a master's thesis in 1999-2000 at the Con.
He was a pool cleaner too, wasn't he?
He cleaned pools and he fixed tellies. Yeah, yeah, that's how much everyone respected his contribution. But he had a... He learned off the great piano player Lenny Tristano and was pretty much Lee Konitz's right-hand sax buddy for years and years. But their whole approach to playing music was about honesty and about hearing the lines in their head before they played it and as they played it. So that was a huge influence on my practicing, on my teaching, on the way I listen to music. And interestingly, I've written to Chris Potter a number of times and asked him about his opinion of Warren, and he loves the guy. And I found that really interesting because I hear in Chris something that I don't hear in many other players, and that is this incredible spontaneity and creativity, yet totally he's unharnessed. He's not controlled, so he's not limited by pre-thought-out phrases, which is what Warren and Lee Konitz and Lenny Tristano were all about. They're all about just totally communicating something that was genuine and honest. And I think what's happened with jazz is that we tend to develop patterns and things that we know that are going to work. So the temptation, I suppose, and especially for a saxophone player, is to pull out things that you know are going to be impressive or that are going to make a crowd go crazy, and that's always a temptation. In terms of how do I measure it, I think I have to measure it with how honest I know I've been in communicating some music.
Many Sydney musicians who I believe would prefer to be performing artists are involved with education simply to make ends meet. What are your thoughts on the Sydney jazz scene, and why is there such a dependency on teaching?
I think that's a very complex question because I don't think there's any one answer, any one dominant picture that comes to mind. I think there's many, many aspects that come together. So, for example, we've got a wonderful Sydney Conservatorium of Music, which has just got fantastic faculty, and the students are just sounding better and better every year. I think the quality is just amazing. You know, you've got these, and what are they doing? So they get out and they start teaching kids how to play instruments and follow their footsteps. I think Sydney's scene is dominated by financial interests. And so whether that be the rent of a particular venue, the rent of where people live in Sydney, so you've got that. I think there's just a general sense in Sydney of people don't really want to be stretched musically. That's what I sense anyway. So we've got a great yearning for nostalgia. You know, another Chisel show or another Guns N' Roses show, or, you know, sometimes even at the basement you have tribute nights.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
How many nights a week?
Yeah. So, and yeah, so the market is dictating that nostalgia and what's been is winning over what might be. And I think that's a shame. I think it's just indicative of a city that's fast-paced and expensive and in a way doesn't take time out to actually be challenged with something new. But they're just some random thoughts. I don't have any great answers.
If you weren't a saxophonist, what do you think you'd be?
I've thought about that a few times. I've gone through all sorts of thoughts. I mean, I should mention that for the last 6 years I was in the Air Force as a musician.
Right.
That's one of the reasons why doing my own record took a long time, because I basically joined the Air Force and started having children. So I've had three children, and then the opportunity came up to record. So that was one of the reasons that it's taken this long. I think, something creative. I'm not sure exactly how that would work itself out. I was also really interested in visual art because my father was an oil painter. So, in fact, when I got into the conservatorium, I was like, actually, I got into Paddington Fine Arts as well.
Okay.
So actually, it was a real choice between music or visual art.
Yep.
So I probably would have done that, actually, come to think of it. Yeah, but I didn't.
All the better for the jazz world here in Sydney that you went on this path, I believe. And this one's called Expectantly Waiting for You. And Richard, is there a story behind this?
There is, Frank. This was written in beginning of 1998, so 10 years ago, and it was written while I was on a tour, actually, with a band, and each venue we got to, there was a piano, and so I'd tinkle out a few more bars and write them down. And at the time, my then-fiancé was in Indonesia doing a backpacking trip, and I kept thinking about her, and so this tune is a love song to her. And then when I got to know Kristen and knew that she'd written some lyrics, I thought, oh, well, I'll let her know about the story and see if she could come up with some lyrics, which she did, and some beautiful lyrics at that. So she wrote the lyrics and I wrote the music.
Richard, you've given a lot to music over quite a long period of time. What's it given back to you?
I suppose it's given back to me lots of great colleagues and friends. It's given to me great opportunities in terms of travel. So I've been to many different cultures, many different places. And that's not just meaning overseas, although it includes that, but one of the intriguing things about music, and I suppose especially about jazz, but it probably applies to many different types of music, and that is that one night you can be playing in the opera house and then the following time you play, it might be at someone's wedding playing background Shania Twain, you know, as they're signing the registry, or, you know, and any number of weird and wonderful combinations in between. You get to see a lot of high-profile people who are letting their guard down, which is always a fascinating experience to watch. Yeah, I think the opportunities that it affords a musician is quite remarkable. So I feel very opened up to what's out there in the world, which can only be a good thing.
Reading recently in the Downbeat magazine, Pat Metheny was quoted as saying, it doesn't take much to honour the effort that somebody takes to come out and hear you. And he goes on to say, when I go hear jazz guys and then they talk among themselves during solos, that makes me want to go home. And I'm mentioning that because presentation on stage, sometimes I go to gigs here in Sydney and the performers just, sometimes they just don't seem as though they've come to perform. They've come to play, but they haven't come to perform. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, unfortunately, for a lot of jazz musicians, they've spent so much time on their own in their bedroom or wherever practicing or just jamming with friends that they do forget that when they go to perform, there is an audience who need to be, in a way, let in on the secret. And that doesn't mean you just sell out as a performer and tell them absolutely everything, but there is a certain amount of including the audience into the mechanics of the ensemble, and everyone's got a different way of doing that. I'm not really great, I don't think, at speaking in front of an audience. I wish I was better, but I suppose I try and let people know that we're just human and we're trying to do our very best for them and for ourselves on stage, and we want it to be a really rewarding experience, and we'd appreciate if they did their best to listen, and we'll do our best to play well for them. So, yeah, I think the point you raise is pretty valid. I've seen jazz bands, particularly jazz guys, who are oblivious to the fact that there's a bunch of people who really love what they're doing, and it's pretty rude, I reckon, in the end, yeah. Mm.
Just briefly, Richard, what's on the horizon after this?
I'm going to be trying to get more gigs for the band, basically. So,
and I know you've got a bit of a story about Highland Cathedral. Mm. Please tell us.
Okay, well, this is quite a story. Basically, being in the Air Force band for 6 years previous to this year, I did a lot of tattoos, a lot of marching, and one of the tunes that I played in that period of time was this wonderful hymn, Highland Cathedral. And it was a very stirring melody, especially it was played on bagpipes, actually. And it had a beautiful, beautiful harmony that accompanied it. Well, anyway, I just memorised this melody and I thought, I'm going to have to use this one day. And so, thinking the tune was, you know, written in 1462, I just took the melody, reharmonised it, said to Kristen, would you like to write some lyrics? She said, yes. So she wrote some beautiful lyrics about her then unborn baby, who's now born, Oliver, who's now 6 months, and her husband, Dave. So two beautiful verses for two most important people in her life. And then it got to February this year, and I think I was talking to maybe my brother one night, and I said, I think, yeah, it's just an old hymn. It'll be out of copyright. And lo and behold, he searches on his laptop, Highland Cathedral, and sure enough, written in 1982 by two Germans. So then began a huge process with Universal Music to get permission to release this song under, you know, with different lyrics. And it was amazing because I was corresponding with Michael Korb, one of the composers, and he was often quite delayed in getting back to me. I sent him the lyrics, I sent him MP3s of the song, I sent Universal as much information as I could, and it was due, this record was due to get cut, so 1,000 copies were going to get made on a Tuesday, and I got an email from him on the Monday night saying, I give you permission to do this. So this record was almost going to have 7 tracks on it, and I'm so grateful that he wrote that email, because it meant that I could get this thing.
Richard, thank you very much for coming into
the
studio.
Thank you, Frank.
Absolute pleasure discussing your album with you.
Thank you very much.